Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to have with me Dr. Elizabeth T. Hurin to tell us all about her book titled The Hidden Histories of the Dead, Disputed Bodies in Modern British Medical Research. This book was published by Cambridge University Press in 2021, and it's fascinating. In the book, there is a whole examination of the multiple journeys that bodies can take after death, not just bodies, but body parts, organs, brains, understanding, mapping out, investigating the culture, really, and the processes of modern British medical research. And this is a fascinating book because quite literally from the beginning to the end of the book takes us from World War II, even sometimes a bit before that, all the way up to the present and shows us that there's history to be understood, but that history very much has current implications. And so I found this book really interesting. And Elizabeth, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the podcast to tell us all about it.
Thank you. Hello. It's really lovely to be with you today.
Before we dive into the book, I'm wondering if you can introduce yourself a bit to our audience and explain how you came to write this.
Sure, it'd be lovely. Well, hello, anyone who's listening. It's really lovely to be with you today. My name is Professor Elizabeth Hurin, and I'm based at the University of Leicester in England. That's sort of in the middle of England if you're listening internationally. And I've worked there now for about 10 years, and I hold a chair in modern British history. But I'm a trained medical historian, essentially, and have done an awful lot of work on the history of the body in my career. And I've been very lucky to have a lot of that work actually funded by the Wellcome Trust in London. It's probably one of the main medical charities that we have in the United Kingdom. Might be familiar to you because it jointly funded the sequencing of the human genome. It also was incredibly active during the recent COVID-19 pandemic, funding incredible cutting-edge research. So it's a very special thing to be associated with. And I do feel very fortunate that they've taken quite a lot of interest in my work. I've been academic now for about 21 years. And you can probably hear it in my voice. I was originally born in Ireland, in the north of Ireland, and I moved to England in about 1988. And I've lived there ever since. And so it's lovely to share with you today some of the findings from the new work and some of the things that I've been working on.
I'm really glad for that introduction because I think the work of the Wellcome Trust is very apparent in the book, the importance of it. And so highlighting it kind of right as we're getting started sets us up very well to dive into the book. And I think one of the important things to think about when examining these hidden histories that you map out is kind of to what extent what lens, I suppose, are we bringing to this mapping process? Because, of course, one of the common criticisms that historians of many stripes get when examining practices that might be ethically tricky by today's standards is, well, but back when these things were being done, it was fine. So why are you making such a fuss about it? So I was wondering if you can sort of help us understand how we can think about today's standards when we're looking at the past.
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that medical science hasn't tended to think about, it's got much better at it, I must say, but it hasn't tended to think about, is that medical ethics isn't a fixed point in time. And of course, it is appropriate that we should study it in its historical context. We can't simply look back at the past and kind of point the finger and say, well, you know, we now know that we should have done. That would be ahistorical, and it would be completely out of context. But that said, you know, medical ethics is an evolving history of itself, and it hasn't tended to have its own histories actually really, really looked at. And the reason that's important is because, largely speaking, medical ethics is a little bit like lots of other types of histories, global histories, histories of colonialism. It's only really since about the 1990s that we began to think about what happened to what could be broadly described as the poor in society, those that were marginalized, discriminated against. And there was a kind of assumption that they were people that didn't write, people that didn't communicate, they were illiterate or semi-literate, and that they didn't have histories. Well, now today we know that's not the case. So medical science is a bit late to come to this realization and to realize that much of its medical ethics has had a very major impact, actually, on those who were, as I said, essentially marginalized. I call that process in the book the way in which sometimes medical science parks things in what I call the cul-de-sac of history. You're not mainstream. We're going to park you in there, and we're not really going to deal with it. And the reason that matters is because if you think about it, numerically, the poor are always the most numerous in society. And so in my work generally, in all the books that I've written, I've studied the poor now from, 1700 right the way through to 2000. And that's actually very unusual to have that long durée. And the thing that you see the most in that is just the amount that we owe the poor for many of the medical breakthroughs that we have actually made globally as a medical scientific community. And yet we don't really acknowledge that. And so it's not enough to park those sort of people in the cul-de-sac of history. They belong in the mainstream just as everybody else does. And that's really, if you like, over my whole career, actually, what I've been trying to do. And I brought it forward in this book to the modern period because it was always, again, assumed that it couldn't be done. And I thought, oh, yes, it can. Let's see what we can do. Let's see if we can find those hidden histories.
I think that's quite often a great sort of spur for really good work is going, I think it is possible, or I actually think there is a story there. So I'm not surprised, particularly given the title Hidden Histories, that was a motivator. And of course, the idea of the debt to the poor and the their lack of voice and involvement is very much a consistent thread throughout the book. But it's not the only theme that's talked about necessarily. So I was wondering if you could maybe introduce us to kind of the themes of the book and explain a bit sort of how you came to them.
Yeah, well, it was partly because having worked really from about 1700 to approximately the 1930s, the Wellcome Trust then came back and said, could you tackle the modern era? And I said, yes, I can. I know I can. So that was, I mean, in one sense, that was a motivation. But I also wanted to finish off the timeline and see what we had done. And I knew the records existed, mainly because the Victorian information state was huge and it expanded. We brought in death certification. We brought in, you know, all the kind of things that censuses, all the big things that structure our modern world. And so, it stood to reason that by the 20th century, that had expanded even more. So the records were there. But it was a question of finding them, really. And what I was really interested in was the fact that we had supposedly very little paperwork to do with the dead themselves. And I kind of thought to myself, well, hang on a moment, we have this enormous bureaucracy. And somewhere within it, it will have betrayed itself, because that's what bureaucracies always do. They don't, you know, they ask you to fill in 12 forms and they never actually then think, oh, what are we going to do with the 12 forms? And they reveal a lot within that kind of paperwork, really. So that's how I kind of approached it. And what I wanted to understand was the post-mortem journeys of the dead, and not just the body as a whole person, but in a modern era then, how did that become what scientists often call biocommons? Now, if you've lost a loved one, my apologies for using that word, because that's very difficult to hear. But the reality is that most people who enter a medical research culture, the body is broken up in some way. It can be a wonderful gift that someone gives in organ donation. It could equally be, a tissue culture. It could help someone with a burn. It might be that someone is interested in helping people with Alzheimer's and they maybe perhaps donate their brain to medical research. So there's a lot of ways that biocommons is created, but it is largely an undocumented biocommons, because once you're merged into the whole, the gift gets lost in it. So I was interested in, could we bring that forth? Could we track? Could we trace? Could we look at the medical legal credentials, the ethical credentials of what we've done? And that's a big theme in the book, and that I did. And then I suppose following on from that, the second theme is really, how did this medical community then conduct itself? What happened to the body that was in the hands of various people, a teaching hospital, a coroner, a pathologist? In other words, what are the kind of actor networks involved in the handling of the dead body? And was there a difference between the rhetoric of the legislation that they were governed by at that time and the reality of what they were actually doing? And I'm always interested in the difference between, if you like, a rhetoric and a reality. And the third thing then was really also about, I suspected, and of course the book documents this, is the way that bureaucracy can kind of be slowed down. And when it gets slowed down in a kind of a bureaucratic process, it starts to create time spaces, spaces in time that the legislation doesn't legislate for, but the system itself creates these, what I call liminal spaces. In other words, there's a kind of medical time that's created. And within that medical time, then you own the body and not the people who are related to the body. Of course, when you're dead, you don't have any legal rights. You're dead. So it passes to your loved ones and relatives. But increasingly in the modern era, those relatives lost a sense of agency with that body, because it was handed over to a lot of medical processes as medical science expanded after 1945. And I was kind of, and I always am very fascinated by these liminal spaces that open up. And what are people really doing in those liminal spaces? Is it what they say they're doing, or is it what they're actually doing? And then that other great thing that all historians are interested in, which is that what is not said is often as important as what is said. And it always is. So what are the silences about this bureaucracy, this medical time, this liminal space that's being created? And I guess the final thing I'm always interested in, I got very interested in this because I did a lot of work on it in the 18th century. And in the 18th century, it was very difficult to time when you actually died. Medical death was called the uncertain certainty. And they had a very complicated language that went like this. And you were almost dead, nearing death, truly dead, absolutely dead. And it was a kind of language. Now, it makes sense that they would be like this in the 18th century. They have a very limited equipment in their doctor's bag. Neuroscience is in its infancy. They're learning the difference between heart-lung death. And then, of course, they suddenly realise there's something called brain death. And this is something, obviously, in the modern era we're more familiar with. But let me just pause a moment and let's just think about this, because the 18th century surgeon has very little equipment and is in a very uncertain situation. The 21st century consultant in resuscitation medicine is highly equipped, highly able to do, to trace the faintest line. But they're in an equivalent situation to the 18th century surgeon, because they can see the faintest trace of lying. And they know that there is this also liminal space in death, and that medical science has been remarkably reluctant to talk about this. I refer to it as in the way that a pathologist would. So it's called perimortem, so that is at or approaching the process of death, and then postmortem, which means obviously that you are in death itself. Now, what we now understand is that that process takes longer than you might think. And it isn't the same for every human being. In fact, lots of people will approach that process in lots and lots of different ways. And I was very interested in how, in the modern period, as we're learning about that, and we're going through a lot of changes in medical ethics because of it, because we start to understand there's a big liminality in death, what then did medical research do with that? Did it keep people alive longer because of the need for organ donation? Need bodies quicker, faster? And that was one of the things I was very interested in. And it's such a current thing. We're still learning about this. You know, this book is not the definitive statement on that. This is where medicine is at today. This is where neuroscience is at. This is the, if you like, the new frontier of medicine, actually, because we know some things about how this works, but we're still learning a lot, really.
Thank you for explaining the themes, not just listing them, but really kind of going into what the questions are and what you find interesting about them. And I think one of the things that revealed is kind of the amount of criticality that you're bringing to this, right? There's, as you said, what's not said is just as interesting as what is, the gaps between what's official policy and what's actually happening.
Yeah.
And this is something that I noticed, it's quite explicit in the book, comes up in terms of how you in the book talk about case studies, mm-hmm. talk about actual examples of actual people when illustrating kind of, okay, well, what happens when the coroner gets the body, or how does this change in medical skills from this time to this time?
Yeah.
And particularly given that so many of the people listening to it, to this episode, are researchers or read researcher involved in that in some way, we do actually think about methods quite a lot. We're really interested in it. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how you approach examples and case studies in your work.
Yeah, sure. The book is based on about, at the back of it is a unique data set. It's got entries of about 500,000 entries in it. It's a huge data set, actually. One of the things that I've been known for in my career is that I'm known for what an historian would call sophisticated record linkage work. It's a lovely term, isn't it? It sounds terribly grand. But what it means is that I've worked with lots of different types of record sets. And I'm known for someone who doesn't just say, here's a story, and I'm going to use this story to illustrate this, and I'm going to tell you it's representative. I've never really been satisfied with that. So what I do is to take a representative selection of cases, usually a spectrum of them, and then I will do as much record linkage work as I can on them. So I'll try to get, if you like, the family story, the coroner story, the pathology story, the medical record from the hospital if I can. So I'll keep working around it until I can build up what I often describe as a mosaic. And out of that mosaic comes then a fuller picture of what we're actually looking at. It's a bit like going into a creative space and keep trying to go in at different doors to try to get in and around as much as you can. And what I'm really looking for there is a more complete picture. I'm not saying all of the pictures are complete. There are always gaps in what we're doing, but it's as complete as I can make it. And I'm also quite conservative about it. I'd rather understate something than overstate something, so that the data, the quantification, numbers, age, demography, all those sort of things, is as, if you like, is as solid and substantial as I can make it. In the modern period, I'm very lucky because we do have big record sets. And strangely, record sets that people have never really used before. I suppose the most obvious in the book are the big sets of anatomy returns that were done. And it amazed me that they hadn't been really systematically used. Then what I'll do is I'll look at a qualitative method. So I look at discourse analysis, as you would expect. I look at language, word patterns, and use methods like Wordsmith, and there are other sort of platforms that we can use today. Look at how words converge. I'm always interested in euphemisms, particularly around death. The medical profession are very, very reluctant often to just say the person died. They'll say things like, your loved one has passed on. Your loved one is no longer with us. Your loved one is absent, or your loved one is just stepped outside. Now, we know why they do that. It's out of kindness. But if you're looking at the discourse that's used, it's very important to understand those euphemisms and why they're being used as well by the profession. So it's a combination of quantitative and qualitative methods. And I'll do then refined case study analysis with them, sophisticated record linkage work, and try to really build that mosaic so that when you stand back from it, you think, okay, there's a very large picture now that's emerging, and it has sort of themes that are coming out from it. And I think this is particularly important when you're looking, you know, when you're looking at the marginalised, you're going to have to work at it, and you're going to have to think a little bit laterally in order to, you know, in order to get at these kind of records. So when I first started working on this, I did a book that lasted from sort of about the 1832s, and everyone told me you absolutely will never find a record of anyone that's ever been dissected. And I remember being in Cambridge, and it was a beautiful, beautiful summer's day. And there was a great Italian restaurant in those days on the Market Square in Cambridge. And I love Italian food. So I popped in and ordered a lovely Italian lunch. And I was sitting there, and I got a great big piece of paper, sort of A3 size. And I thought, OK, if a body dies, what bureaucracy gets created? Where might it be? And it was that sort of lateral thinking that process that I'm kind of always looking for all of the time. Where might the bureaucracy have started? Where might I be able to go in on a different door sort of for it? So that's what enabled me to build up quite so many case records. And obviously, you know, it takes time. It does take a lot of time, and you've got to be persistent, a little bit stubborn. Just final thing I would add to that, really, on methods, is there was an ethical challenge as well in doing this, because I did spend a lot of time thinking about, I am in a modern period. Historians like to work with 100-year rules, so we don't like to come past, you know, more than 100 years ago, because we do need to reflect on how much we can identify of case histories, because relatives could be connected or still alive. So everything was very, very carefully coded. It was done, obviously, with a great deal of confidentiality. And I did it in such a way that it would be impossible for anyone except myself to re-identify. And if I wasn't sure, if there was an element of the personal in it that I felt, ooh, that might be, you know, it could in the future lead to a re-identification or a question mark, then I took it out. I was trying to be as careful about that as I could, because it's a generic that we're interested in. Some things that were in the public domain, where families were very willing to put them into the public domain, then those obviously one can treat as in a different way. But I do think you need to be sensitive to record sets.
Mm. Well, I think that's worth raising sort of as a follow-up, because you're sensitive about the data and the confidentiality, but also in how you tell stories of individual people throughout the book. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit as well to kind of how you approach that sort of writing.
Yeah, I mean, for my thesis, actually, I'm a trained poverty historian, and I'm used to doing really detailed, census linking work, epidemiologies, all sorts of things, really. And so what I suppose the training really enables me to be more thoughtful at this stage in my career as to how I'm going to put a story together and which elements of that story are, as it were, serving the historical questions, and which it would be intrusive of me as an historian to crash into, would be the best way to say it, you know, because I wouldn't want to do that. So I am always particularly sensitive as well if the story relates to a child. I happened as a human being to hold that, you know, that the loss of a child, I think, is probably one of the most difficult things that any human being can experience. So I would be really very meticulous about those and would really think very, very carefully about how I would present that. And obviously some stories of people whose bodies were donated or end up in dissection rooms, they can have traumatic stories attached to them. And it's not just actually the trauma for the family. I learned this quite some time ago, actually. I was invited into dissection rooms, and what was interesting about it, there are lots of interesting lessons, but perhaps one of the most intriguing in one way, or surprised me, was that many of the people that run the dissection rooms themselves, if they work in hospitals, they sometimes find it very difficult to work in the dissection room because they are dealing with their failures, and it can be very poignant for them. So I think it's something that people don't often think about. They think about everyone having the clinical mentality, but not necessarily still feeling that human connection. And it's important to stress, you know, that medical sciences do still feel that human connection and can do. So it's really about being thoughtful about that, really, and then sort of putting together circumstances. But I would hold back personal details that I felt were going a little far. Maybe perhaps in a case of a suicide, for example. I'm just trying to think of some others that I might do. Maybe a family circumstances. I might not explain everything because it's not necessary for the nature of the historical inquiry that we're looking into. So, you know, it's one of these difficulties. The historian has a duty. They have a medical ethics. And I guess I come back to the Hippocratic Oath, actually. I sometimes ask myself, will this do no harm? It's the basis of medicine itself. I think historians sometimes have to ask themselves that question too.
Well, speaking of the medical profession and how it operates, I'm wondering if we can do a little bit of a very high-level tour of the things that you go into much more detail about in the book, about understanding the sort of threshold points for medical research and the ways in which kind of this culture interacts with, bluntly, dead bodies.
Sure. So one of the things that hasn't tended to be thought about really is that is the threshold points that the body passes through. So I'm going to simplify them because I think I don't think there's anything wrong with that, actually. But in the book itself, what I kind of wanted to do was, first of all, I wanted to find what these threshold points were. So obviously the first point, threshold point, is when someone dies and death is declared. Now, as I've said, this can be a little bit more complex than people think. So, but let's assume that we're at the point of death, as it were. Then the second threshold point is there a bequest after 1945 for that body or not? Now, in Britain, most bequests really began in 1952. And actually, a surprising number of bodies were not bequested at first. There were people that left the body to medical research, but a significant number actually didn't. And then we enter into threshold point three, which is that if they were not a fully bequested body at that stage, nonetheless, the body is about to pass into this third stage, which is into the medical research culture itself. And it could do that in a number of ways. It would depend really where you died. But so if you died in a teaching hospital, for example, very common in the 1950s with the NHS, of course, opening up healthcare to everyone, free at the point of delivery in the way they'd not done before, clearly the body is going to go to a pathologist in a hospital. So that would kind of be that way. If it was a road traffic accident, then it would be the coroner's office. So you are entering then into this passing over this third threshold, and you're going into a medical research culture at that point, not as a bequest, but as a process of the bureaucracy of death, if you like. Part of that will also be that, particularly again, in, you know, from the Medical Act in 1858 onwards, there is a demand for bodies for human anatomy teaching, and that demand is always there. It hasn't gone away. And most medical schools need about 50 to 60 bodies per year to actually train medical students on. So there is then sort of at this point, this threshold point, we go to a fourth one. And then it's really what happens when the body is officially owned by part of this medical research culture. And what then happens to it in the next 2 to 3 years? Now, today, you know, largely speaking, since the 1890s, we've had better refrigeration techniques, better preservation techniques. So the body can be kept in a way that in the Victorian period, it could not have been kept. So we can keep the body for a lot longer. So it's what then happens in that fourth threshold point that when it's crossed. And this is the moment when I got very interested in what ethnographers refer to as, how is legality actually experienced at each of these threshold points? In what ways is medical science taking a global view of what it's doing? In what ways is it, as it were, going through these sets of legal processes that it meets at each of these threshold points, but at the same time, it could perhaps be going around the law because it can hold the body for periods of time, which I mentioned earlier, in liminal bureaucratic spaces. So each threshold point then is important because you're slipping over into this culture. You're getting deeper into it. And it's at that point when the ownership of the body really does pass over to medical science. So that's what the book's really interested in. And it takes you through a number of cases. I won't repeat these here. But I take you through cases where literally you follow the body. You take its journey so that we can understand that a little bit better. And the purpose of doing that is to try to get to the points of those thresholds where disputes could potentially have happened and which essentially were hidden, covered over, neglected, or perhaps were taboo to talk about.
And you, in fact, group these disputes into three categories. And I'm wondering if you can explain what they are and maybe give us an example.
Sure, absolutely. So the first type of dispute is what I would call an implicit dispute. A person dies, as I've been describing. The body enters a medical research culture or a teaching culture, depending on what's happening to the body. And at this point, and this was very common in the 1950s, consent is implied, but it's never really documented for the bereaved. And the procedures, therefore, of consent, they look robust, but the bureaucracy itself is terribly light touch. And the audit procedures for that bureaucracy are actually delegated to those who are taking ownership of the body. So it's sort of in everyone's interest at this stage to do this light touch bureaucracy and to imply that the consent process is actually there. And once you've done a kind of implied consent process, you can then potentially have an implicit dispute that can arise. This would be typically where a family thought that a body was going for a post-mortem to check just on how their loved one died. And this was very common in the 1950s, 60s, 70s even. What they didn't know was all the other things that were done around that process. And these only came to light, actually. You'll probably all, some of you, I'm sure, will remember around the NHS scandals in the around about 2000 in the NHS, when we began to realise that we had lots of things in storage that nobody had ever really thought about, how it actually got into storage and what uses were being made of it. And that was that's what that first nature of dispute was. It was an implicit dispute, really, that was being done. So that was the first sort of set, really. The second set, then, is what I would call an explicit dispute. Now, here, the way I could illustrate this, really, is with the coroner. The coroner has very extensive powers, as you would appreciate, and it's quite right that they do. They have to decide how a person died and were the circumstances, as it were, not foul play. I mean, that's essentially the coroner's role. Was it a natural death, essentially? Now, when the body passes over to the coroner, despite what the family might want, or despite what the person who died might want, the coroner has ultimate control over that body, because the nature of looking into a cause of death has to take priority from it. So if someone said, oh, I would like my body to go to medical research, the coroner actually can completely overrule that. And they can say, no, that's not in the interest of what I need to do. I am here to decide the balance of probability of your death and its cause of death. And I am going to decide what's going to happen. Now, that seems terribly sensible. But in the modern era, it's complicated because, for example, a coroner may have a complicated case. Let's say it's a road traffic accident. Let's say it's the 1960s. And the person who's died has decided that they want to donate their heart to be donated. But there's an outstanding coroner's case. So there becomes a tussle between the family, if you like, on the one hand, on behalf of the dead person, and the coroner as to the status of the heart. The coroner needs it for the case, but it's an organ that needs to be transplanted quickly and to fulfill a dying loved one's wishes. And the book explores that tension because it results in a lot of explicit disputes. There are families who feel very, very, they feel that their grieving process is made much worse by the fact that they can't fulfill their loved one's wishes in a particular way. And so the book explores that second type of dispute in depth, really. And then the third type of dispute is a missed dispute. Now, a typical case would be where, because of delayed or missing information, the family had no idea that they should make a deeper inquiry. They'd no idea, for example, that, let's look at pathology. Pathologists would have worked on aspects of the body maybe for the coroner, and they would have established a cause of death. But the law was so loose between roughly 1950 and the Human Tissue Act of 2005 that it was possible for researchers to take other bits of the body that they saw were interesting to work upon. In one sense, this is the furtherance of medical science. It's an important endeavour. But it does give rise to a missed dispute because a person, a family member, wouldn't necessarily have known that that was so, and they missed the opportunity to dispute or inquire about this. So let me give you a practical example. Might be someone whose loved one was very sadly involved in a crime that resulted in their death, a murder. And they would have thought that the coroner and the pathologist took enough of the body to satisfy the particular court case. And that would be very sensible, of course, because that evidence needs to come to court. What they didn't know was that the police and the pathologist and other researchers had an opportunity to take more research material from that body and to store it over a very long period of time. And it was the case that some people then got written to and told that there were aspects of their loved ones that were being retained, but they didn't know at all relate to the crime or the court case that, and its specifics and its forensics, if you like, that was necessary to effect a prosecution in court. And that came as quite a shock to quite a lot of families, and was quite a revelation, actually, to a lot of people who thought they were genuinely working within the law. As well. So these kind of three, this is the third step of those disputes, a missed dispute. So I was interested then in, you know, the implicit dispute, the explicit dispute, and then the missed dispute. And this seemed to be, in the book, it's a way of organising the kind of body disputes that can occur.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Thank you for explaining the three categories and a bit of kind of what that might actually look like in a particular case. And in a lot of ways, these disputes demonstrate a kind of clash between expectations, really. Mm. You mentioned a number of times sort of they assumed this or they thought this, yes, and that was sensible, but that's not actually what happened.
Yeah.
And this is something that I sort of draw a link to something else you talk about in the book, of the transition from what you call the ethics of conviction to what you then call the ethics of responsibility.
Yeah.
And this idea of kind of, well, whose best interest are we serving? Mm. Who gets to make decisions? And given that we've kind of been talking about this, you know, this phrase, the British medical research culture, can you tell us a bit about that transition?
Sure. I think one of the things that the Human Tissue Act of 2005, and one of the reasons it was passed actually, was that after a number of inquiries, quite high profile ones, between 2000 essentially and, well, 1999 really actually, and 2004, was that there had to be an acknowledgement that ownership of the body had largely been about what I would call proprietorial medical ethics. And this rose out of the sense in which medicine owns the body. And there's a kind of benign paternalism is the best way to kind of explain that, in the way that people thought about that at that time. We do things that are in the interest of everyone. It arose out of a Jeremy Bentham idea, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. Therefore, we need to do this because it advances medicine. Now, on the one hand, that's very laudable, actually, because, you know, we are all the beneficiaries of medical science. I wouldn't suggest otherwise. But it started to give rise to a clinical mentality, which was that the person in the lab or the pathologist or the coroner or whoever had it, they actually owned that. It was theirs. And that's what I mean by an ethics of conviction. By conviction, you believe that your clinical output must take absolutely a priority. Now, not all clinical outputs did. Some, like the coroner, for example, establishing a cause of death, very necessary. Others were about people's pursuit of their own research interests and the conviction that they owned that body and that their research in agenda, their research pursuit was entirely proper. Now, I'm not suggesting that all of those that acted like that acted illegally. In fact, the law itself was terribly piecemeal. There were statutes that went back to the 1830s. They were revisited in the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. And I document that in the book for those that are interested. But what you see with those statutes is that they never actually went back to the original legislation and said, is this fit for purpose? So the legislation itself also ran by an ethics of conviction, an ethics of proprietorial use of the body, because nobody actually thought to go back and actually check. And this gave rise actually to a lot of people working within the system who actually did genuinely believe that they were working properly to the law, when in fact they were working to something that was clunky, had lots of loopholes, and was not actually, and hadn't been for, you know, over 100 years, very fit for purpose, and certainly not in a modern biomedical age. So there are reasons why we arrived at an ethics conviction and why an ethics of proprietorial medical ethics was, if you like, the order of the day. But it wasn't, there wasn't enough thought put in, should this actually be the case as we move into a modern world, democracy, we're global citizens, we want to be part of something, we want transparency. Today we believe in open access to knowledge. Of course, we have the internet and everything that that opportunity arises for us. So what's happened is that very slowly, really from the 1990s onwards, there had to be a recognition, and it was a painful one actually for many areas of the culture of medicine, to move over to an ethics of responsibility. You don't have a proprietorial sense over the body anymore. You have a custodial sense. You are a custodian of the knowledge. You're holding it in trust. So it's still fulfilling that very important agenda that you're looking for, those major breakthroughs for humanity. But a custodian never has a sense of ownership. They are looking after it. They are handing it over the generations. And so the mentality had to transition to this ethics of responsibility. And in the book, that's what I've tried to show, really, that the tension that there was in that transition, and that, you know, we have transitioned a lot towards it, but it's not fully actually yet. It really isn't in some areas of medicine. We still have more work to do and more work to think about that ethics of responsibility. But it's a really important transition that in a biomedical world we have to make if we are to share in the benefits of everything that we can do together, and at the same time acknowledge where those benefits are coming from, the poor, the marginal, however you know, we arrive at particular medical research results. So my Irish granny always used to say, in life, it's really important that you keep thinking and understanding that you can be sincere. And if you'll forgive my bad grammar, you can also be sincerely wrong sometimes. And that really is about that transition. We were sincere in an ethics of conviction, but we had to recognise we were also sincerely wrong in that. It wasn't fit for purpose. And that's when we moved over to an ethics of responsibility.
Hmm. Thank you for explaining that transition and adding that nuance to it, right? It's not like people went around saying, we're going to do this and we know it's bad, right? That would not be an accurate understanding, but a very easy one to kind of, you know, smear a headline on.
Yes, it was, yes. And, you know, it's been difficult. There are people who've left, for example, the pathology profession because they feel it has swung too far. Ethics evolves. It's a conversation. We have to keep thinking about it. You know, one of the criticisms at that time that was made was people were very worried about the Human Tissue Act because it seemed to ask such a high level of consent. And I remember there was a lot of criticism around when it was originally passed, 2004, 2005. And the criticism was, well, isn't medicine serendipity? You know, sometimes things can just happen. Mistakes can be made with things. And aren't we going to lose those opportunities? And, you know, there was genuine debate about that at the time. But now, you know, 20 years on or so, it's interesting, there have been a number of Royal Society of Medicine, for example, has really reflected on those past 20 years. And there is a recognition we really did need to make that transition across so that medicine is now not risk averse, it's risk aware. And that's what an ethics of conviction does. An ethics of conviction is wanting to hold on to and to hold, whereas a custodial medical ethics will say, I am going to be very aware of what I'm doing. That's not going to stop me what I'm doing. I'm just going to make sure that I do the consent process and I keep that dialogue up. And that's a transition that we've made. But it's been painful sometimes. And, you know, there are elements in the book where I document that too.
So speaking of being aware, because that's obviously a lot of the part of the idea of a Hidden Histories book, of mapping it out, there's not just a sort of historian's imperative to it of, well, as historians, we want to actually understand what happened and why in and of itself. Mm. You also document some very clear practical consequences of ignoring these hidden histories of disputes around dead bodies.
Yeah.
What are they?
Well, there are a number of things in the book, really, because one of the things that really surprised me was how little, for example, we use the information that come out of coroner's inquests. They should have been, as I point out in the book, a treasure trove of information. But we underfunded the coroner's service for a very long time. And so people were really pushed to do inquests. We didn't actually, pushed so much actually that handwriting was illegible. We didn't collate the information, absolutely hugely valuable information that you would think would be actually collated together to tell us about the trends that are actually happening that the dead are helping us to understand. You know, at the moment we are an aging society and coroners deal with a lot of aging bodies, and they have been doing so really roughly since about the 1980s, when people started to live really beyond the age of 85. I remember when 85 in the 80s seemed, wow, someone lived to 85. By the 90s, end of the 90s, people are living to the 90s and beyond, actually. So historically speaking, we're aging much, much longer. But is our quality of life as good is a very, very important question. And it's a question that all of that wonderful information from coroners could have answered. But we didn't give coroners the opportunity to actually collate that information, to make it legible, to be that treasure trove of information that we've actually needed. And that is a lost opportunity. There's absolutely no question about that. So that's been one of the tensions inside the system. Another tension that I touch on is that we've had a number of organ donation campaigns, and anyone who's ever been on an organ donation list will know just how frustrating it is to be waiting on the right organ, and waiting lists can be tremendously long. And the NHS has done a lot of campaigns around carrying organ donation cards. As you know, there's been, many of you who are listening will know, there's been a great change in the last 10 years or so, but notably under the government of Theresa May in Britain, when she was Prime Minister, that unless you opted out, your organs would be taken. And there's big debates about, you know, is that ethically sound? Is that custodial medical ethics? You know, there was a lot of debates kind of around that. Now, out of that, the NHS went on the campaign trail in 2020, and it said, what we really need to do is to change the attitudes of young people. Young people then can talk to their families and they can say, no, we want to do organ donation. And this will really create a grassroots movement, and that will help people who are waiting on these long donation lists. Now, this was very well meant as a campaign, but it didn't and was not based on any substantive research. This is the problem. So when I created the data set and put together all of the data I could acquire on the bequests, what was really interesting was that the people that bequest the most are mothers and grandmothers of their own bodies. They are the drivers of giving organs, of giving their bodies to medical research. And this was a finding that emerged very strongly, actually, out of the evidence base. And of course, mothers and grandmothers are absolutely fantastic at keeping conversations going in families. If your granny asks you to do something, you do tend to listen, or at least I certainly used to. So they are the people, actually, who are the linchpin of this system. but we've never had the data because we hid the data and we didn't want to talk about it. So I've just given you two examples, but it's just what happens when we tuck something in a drawer or we don't want to talk about it. We lose opportunities that are actually very important, and they have real consequences for people in need of heart transplants, organ donation, and we could do better about it, really. And I guess it's why I suppose as an historian, I'm very committed to sharing that research and trying to show that, you know, it has real life consequences if we keep getting it wrong.
Mm. I thought that was such a compelling example in the book. And again, when you've just recounted it here, that the policy expectation was, well, these are going to be the drivers of the policy. Mm. And the investigation of what actually happened, as was so true throughout the mosaics you put together in the book, revealed a very different picture, which leads me to, I suppose, my penultimate question of what are the kind of policy implications of this work?
Well, I'd say that, I mean, there are a lot, actually, really. I mean, the biggest one, really, I think, I suppose, in many ways, and the one I'm, I think I'll probably remain fascinated by to the end of my career, because it is the frontier of medicine, is this whole question of medical death. I think it's utterly fascinating. We have really got to think about the way we die, how we die. Most people don't fear death. After all, you're dead. So, you know you're dead and you are in a dead state. I mean, it's semantic, but it's true. But it's how we die that people fear. And because we've never really understood this liminal space between perimortem, the act of being towards, coming towards dying, and postmortem, in death itself, and because we haven't wanted to discuss that liminal space and the fact that lots of people enter that space in very different ways, biologically, psychologically, depending on, you know, what's happening to your body, we have been very, very reluctant to look into that in any detailed way. I wouldn't say it's quite the last taboo, but it's a very uncomfortable conversation that people don't really want to have. And it's becoming an important conversation to us, because the more sophisticated that we get, the more that we can trace things to the nth degree with all our equipment, the more ethically difficult it is for someone to actually manage that in resus medicine, A&E, depending, you know, accident, emergency. It depends where you sort of arrive at. But for me, one of the lessons of the future is we've got to look at that more carefully. And we've also got to think about, do we need what I call in the book a national ethics trust? I call it a safety net, the net. Do we, in a modern world, need something that stands in parallel to medicine and to the courts, the law courts? Because often difficult or controversial cases where, for example, someone has to, a hospital applies to turn off life support, that will all necessarily end up in a law court if there's a dispute about it. Do we need something that's parallel to that? Do we need a national body, which I call the NET, the National Ethics Trust? Do we need those cases not to appear, as often happens, highly emotional on social media, where they're wildly debated, very difficult for all of those involved on all sides? Do we need something where actually we look at it and think, okay, what is the liminality of death? What is the quality of life of the person? What are we going to do in this space? And I would suggest increasingly in where we are in a biomedical world, we do need to. Now, I'm not talking about legislation about euthanasia. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm trying to say is that we have a wonderful gift of biomedicine that's been given to us, but it's a complicated gift, and it presents families at their most emotional with sometimes an overload of information and not really knowing what to do. And it's really difficult sometimes to handle that. And I quote the work actually of Sam Parnier in the book, who I'm a great admirer of, Professor Sam Parnier's at Stony Brook in Hospital in New York in resus medicine. And Sam Parnier has shown that the more that we oxygenate the brain and the more that we keep it oxygenated in trauma, the more that the 20-minute mark of calling death in accident emergency is a nonsense. That many people under the right medical conditions will survive that and will come back with a better quality of life. So we know that liminality exists. And in an aging population, we need to talk about that liminality. So I think that's probably one of the things that I was kind of really interested in. The other thing that I'm really interested in is pollution. We live at a time of climate change. We live at a time when we are discovering lots of things about our world and the way that we pollute our world. And this is a hugely important debate, especially and particularly young people at the moment. One of the things that surprised me was that we've never really used all of the anatomy or dissection data because it was never placed in open access and it was never looked at systematically. And we've never looked over a long period of time what that data was actually telling us. And it has some lessons actually for us, some very, very important ones. So I've looked now at data from 1750 to 2000. And the thing that's interesting about that data is that in all periods and all times, the majority of people who live in poverty, who die in what we would call marginal circumstances of deprivation of one sort or another, in Britain, obviously I've only done, but they all die of lung complaints. In the past, it would have been a mixture of what they called phthisis or TB, but also coal smog before the Clean Air Act of 1952. Then after the Clean Air Act, and we dealt with coal smog, we replaced coal smog with car smog. And we're only beginning to understand about asthma. We're beginning to understand that pollution from the car can, for example, exacerbate dementia. And that people are still dying of, broadly speaking, lung complaints. So in our search for data to really understand the way that we're ordering our world and the way that we're polluting our world and the importance of, if you like, an environmentalism and to be environmentally aware, because we hid all of this, we hid the lessons of pollution and what we're doing to ourselves. And I think that was also, I kind of think, one of the lessons for the future. I've only done this in a small way, but there will be other data out there. There will be other trends that we should be looking at. And we should really be thinking about, as I said in the book, you know, biomedicine works best when it is as easy as breathing. We are so lucky if we can breathe in fresh air because that's what the data shows. It shows that the quality of our life is significantly enhanced. And I think for me, that's a really pressing lesson that we need to talk about also much more. But we can talk about it in a data way. We can talk about it actually by looking over this long kind of stretch of time. And we should be talking about it. I mean, I know that there are neuroscientists, they may be listening in. I know they're working on what they call the polluted brain, that the closer that you live to road traffic, the more the evidence seems to be showing that that might increase your prevalence for dementia. It's an important debate we need to be having.
Well, now that you've brought us through the history, the present, and now looked into the future, that leaves only my final question about your immediate future. The book obviously is out and available for people to read. Is there anything you're currently working on or looking to work on next, whether it's a book or something else or a whole combination of things, that you'd like to make our listeners aware of?
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I think you could always criticize of an historian that works on the marginal is Elizabeth, have you found any sources by the marginal speaking in their own words and not, as it were, through my mediated words of data and all the rest of it? So what I have been working on is over a 20-year period, I've collected 8 million words of stories by poor people in their own words. So that's what I'm working on at the moment. So my next book, which I'm going to publish with Oxford University Press, is called Histories of Nobody. And it's really about the way that poor people actually talked about their bodies in the past, in their own words. So if you like, it's kind of an acknowledgement that I need to stand back and I need to let them speak. So I feel very privileged to have this amount of data, and I'm very grateful to all the people that have funded me over a period of time. So I'm knee deep in that at the moment. In fact, I was writing it today, and I hope it will be illuminating. I hope that it will be above all human, because I think that's one of the things that I don't know. I think it's a kind of a commitment, really, that all historians have, is to bring forward all of the wonderful complexions of humanity. Yeah, let's see how it goes.
Well, that's a very exciting project. So best of luck being knee deep in that. But while you work on it, of course, listeners can read the book we've been discussing, again, titled Hidden Histories of the Dead, Disputed Bodies in Modern British Medical Research. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
It's a pleasure. And thank you to everyone that's listening in. And do get in contact with me, actually. I'd love to hear from anyone who's interested, because it's, yeah, I mean, history is a big conversation, and aren't we all lucky to be part of it?